Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Stephanie Lecce, in for Don Marsh. Protests in response to the grand jury decision in the Darren Wilson-Michael Brown case have continued to impact Ferguson and cities across the country, including New York, Chicago, and Kansas City. 2,200 National Guard troops are in the greater St. Louis area after more than a dozen buildings burned in Ferguson during Monday's unrest. And yesterday, protesters shut down a portion of a St. Louis highway and demonstrated outside the Ferguson Police Department, where police say they made at least 45 arrests. We've also seen signs of the community coming together. Meanwhile, Officer Wilson has given his first media interview to ABC News, in which he said he feels sorry for the death of Michael Brown, but that he couldn't have done anything differently. And this morning, Brown's mother called Wilson's comments describing Brown as looking like a demon with, quote, almost unfathomable aggression, disrespectful. Our reporters in the St. Louis Public Radio newsroom are working their way through the grand jury documents released by St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCullough. We'll talk with them in just a little bit. And we'll also hear from St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay about how his city is coping in the wake of some destructive demonstrations in the Shaw neighborhood. We'll also hear from the president of the NAACP, Cornell Brooks, about the organization's reaction to the grand jury decision. But first, we're going to turn to our St. Louis Public Radio reporter, Jim Howard, in Washington, D.C., to get some federal reaction. Jim?
Hi, Stephanie. Who says you can't win with the backup quarterback?
There you go. So what are we hearing from federal officials about their reaction to the grand jury?
Well, I think probably the most notable federal official at the moment that is getting news attention is Attorney General Eric Holder. Yesterday, he briefly briefed the president on the latest events in Ferguson, and then shortly after that, he met with his top staff on all of the different departments dealing with issues in Ferguson. You've got the independent investigation on the shooting of Michael Brown. You have the investigation into the civil rights issues in Ferguson's police department, the so-called patterns and practices investigation that's underway. He said that both of those, even though they were in a mature state, meaning that the investigations have moved along, were still taking place, were still independent, that they were pursuing them with rigor and expected to move forward expeditiously. I think all of those comments are aimed at those not happy with the grand jury's decision in Ferguson, to let them know that this decision by itself is not the only thing to expect. At the same time, the Attorney General says that they are not prejudging any of the evidence, and that while there is a very high legal bar that is imposed on a civil rights investigation, that they're still keeping their minds open as they evaluate the evidence.
Now, are there any other avenues that the Attorney General or the Justice Department may pursue?
Well, and not so much in terms of other legal avenues. They have the two investigations underway. Probably the one with the most serious potential implications is the civil rights investigation that's being done on the Ferguson Police Department. This is not the first patterns or practices investigation to take place in the United States. And specifically, they're looking for, you know, how police officers in Ferguson conduct their business, especially when they engage individuals in the minority community. And they've looked at this in other departments across the country. You'll remember when the Attorney General announced this investigation, he said that they had already looked at a number of documents and they found enough information there, enough reasons to go forward with the investigation. At the same time, when he was talking to reporters here in Washington, he said that there is a very high legal bar. It's a very specific set of standards that you have to satisfy before you can come back and say that there is a systematic violation of constitutional rights that warrants bringing federal charges. There are other remedies, there are other avenues that the Department of Justice can and is using to address this, and they've done this in a number of other cities across the country, and that goes more to what is known as the Collaborative Reform Program that's in place through the Community-Oriented Policing Services Office, known by its acronym as COPS. That's underway, and that's going at pretty full tilt. Training has already been provided. That's being conducted through St. Louis County Police Department. The county sheriff asked for the collaborative review process, so it's a voluntary request on his part for technical assistance, and that's a multi-year effort with an outside entity contracted through the Department of Justice to go in and look at how the department deals with all sorts of things. Now, St. Louis County police were not involved in the shooting of Michael Brown. They investigated the shooting afterwards, but a lot of that got tied together in the aftermath of the initial unrest.
Now, Jim, you listened yesterday in on a conference call with national civil rights organizations, including one of our guests coming up, Cornell Brooks of the NAACP, in which they talked about loopholes in the guidance regarding the use of race by federal law enforcement agencies. Can you tell us a little bit about what this guidance is and what these civil rights leaders might be referring to when they talk about loopholes?
Certainly. This is a very, very important issue, and it's probably a pretty deep issue. It's not the kind of stuff that's going to come up over Thanksgiving conversation for most of us. But in February of 2001, President George W. Bush addressed a joint session of Congress, and he talked about how racial profiling was wrong. He said, in fact, quote, "It was wrong and we will end it in America." At that time, he instructed the then Attorney General John Ashcroft to formulate guidelines by which federal law enforcement could deal with the issue of race in conducting law enforcement investigations or arrests, etc. And basically what it said was that you cannot use racial profiling, with a couple of big asterisks in here, and that's where these civil rights groups are concerned with. The initial document is an 11-page document. It spells out specific situations in which race cannot be used as a determiner of whether or not an individual is likely to have engaged in criminal behavior. It says it can be used if the race of an individual is important in the description of someone that you're looking for. But here's where the big concern comes in for a whole number of civil rights groups across the country. It excludes issues of national security. So when 2001 and the attacks in September of that year happened, a lot of the momentum to bring about an end to racial profiling, to look at the sensitivity of this issue, to recognize that racial profiling is not only ineffective, it's unsafe for law enforcement because it's based on assumptions that just mean nothing, can waste resources, it can put officers in danger if they're acting on those stereotypes, but it excludes issues of national security. So at the time that the attacks in September 2001 occurred, all of these guidelines went right out the window, and police and law enforcement officials detained 1,200 individuals of Muslim and Eastern Middle Eastern background and Southeast Asian background, all based on stereotypes or biases or assumptions in terms of their search for who may have perpetrated that. And that's probably the biggest loophole that these civil rights groups want to plug, is that specifically one of their bullet points is to eliminate the loopholes, allowing profiling to occur under the guise of national security and at U.S. borders. The border protection officers are not under this guidance, and these groups believe that should be in place too. They also want to expand the definition of those protections under this guidance in regarding the use of race in federal law enforcement, and extend its reach to any local law enforcement agency that would accept federal dollars.
And so that obviously would include the Ferguson Police Department.
To the extent that they accept any federal dollars, one of the individuals that was speaking in this conference call yesterday was Sherilyn Eiffel from the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. And she looked at, now these groups have a long list of issues that they have been working on for decades trying to get at, not the least of which is the very long effort to pass the End Racial Profiling Act in Congress, backed and championed by Michigan Congressman John Conyers. A number of other individuals are on board on this. But Sherilyn Eiffel from the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund talked about going after conditions on about $400 million in federal grants. And that is not the full extent of all of the federal money that can flow to local police departments. But as she described it, that money is available without condition. And she talked about the importance of potentially attaching conditions to require law enforcement agencies to engage in training for implicit bias. And we know that in St. Louis County, through the COPS program, through this collaborative reform program that's in place, that what was called the command and community level of individuals, about 30, have already gone through training on implicit bias. And we can get into implicit bias a little bit more down the road. But she looked at the idea of, we have all this money, this taxpayer money, flowing to these departments. Use it as an incentive. Use it as a lever to try to engineer the kind of change that they advocate for in the relationship between local law enforcement and the communities they serve.
Now, Jim, you are in Washington, D.C. What are you hearing from Capitol Hill? How has Missouri's congressional delegation responded not only to the grand jury decision, but also to the unrest we've seen Monday night and even a little bit last night?
Well, I universally, Senator Roy Blunt, Senator Claire McCaskill, Representative Clay, Representative Cleaver, although not in St. Louis, clearly very interested in issues that affect the African-American community. Representative Ann Wagner from the 2nd Congressional District, all have expressed their disappointment in the violence that has taken place. All have expressed their desire that individuals who may not agree with the grand jury's decision at least protest peacefully. Unfortunately, we saw in a large measure that did not happen. It may have been relatively few individuals in terms of the overall numbers of those who came out to protest or voice their opposition to this decision. But all of those members, in one way or another, have been involved in this. I think Senator Claire McCaskill has probably been, along with Representative Clay, probably been the most active in trying to communicate between law enforcement and the organizers of protesting before the decision came down. At one point, Senator McCaskill said she felt like she was involved in shuttle diplomacy, trying to respect the wishes of law enforcement and at the same time find ways to effectively protect property and people and the rights, First Amendment rights of individuals. And she talks frequently about the rich history of civil disobedience in the country. And there's going to be a lot of work that's going to have to be engaged in the days, weeks, and months ahead as we get beyond what has taken place over the last couple of days. But that's what we're hearing from those individuals. Beyond that, this past summer, the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation Legislative Conference held a number of discussions on Michael Brown's shooting and the situation in Ferguson, and they used that as the latest peg to look at this long effort to pass the End Racial Profiling Act in Washington. Now, Missouri, many years ago, was one of the very first states to enact, at the time, what was a fairly comprehensive law to look at this issue, to require the collection of data and reporting information. We know the Attorney General's office at the state level provides reports on that annually. But at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation conference this summer, a number of members, Representative Clay was there, a number of members talked about the need for congressional hearings to look at Michael Brown's shooting. I've been on the phone all morning this morning with congressional offices, Senate offices, committee offices, the House Committee on the Judiciary. Staff and I had a good conversation this morning. During the convention this summer, Representative Conyers talked about these hearings. Unfortunately, the way it works on Capitol Hill is the majority party, in this case House Republicans, are in control of the committees. It is up to the chairman, the majority member, the chairman of the committee, to call for a hearing. You know, and for any number of reasons, there's questions as to whether or not that would happen. But John Conyers is the ranking member on the committee. He is the highest ranking Democrat on the committee, and he has the ability, if need be, to call essentially for what would be known as a field hearing or a minority hearing, where you may not have an official hearing in the sense of how Congress deems hearings to be official, but it still gives them the ability to bring this issue up, to ask witnesses to come in. I don't believe in a field hearing they can compel individuals because it's not official, but they can certainly ask sympathetic individuals to come in and to testify about all of the issues that they see related to the relations between law enforcement, bias training, minority communities, how training that's out there that to de-escalate violent or tense situations. They can get into all of that, and I imagine that when they come back after the Thanksgiving break next week, even though the pressing business at the moment is just a couple of weeks left to figure out how to fund the government through the rest of this fiscal year and to handle the number of things that they have to before the 113th Congress goes out of business, that there are going to be a number of members of the Congressional Black Caucus talking about what to do next to keep the spotlight on this event.
All very applicable issues right now. Jim Howard, thanks so much, and get back to reporting.
Will do. Thank you.
We're going to turn now to another reporter quickly from our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom, Camille Phillips, who is on the scene at a protest on Market near City Garden. Camille, are you hearing me all right?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're coming through pretty clear. Camille, what are you seeing right now? What's going on?
Well, we actually moved to Pier Plaza. I'm standing there now. They're chanting different things. There's about 100, maybe 150 people here. I can tell you what happened just a little while ago. They were at City Hall.
Sure, that would be great. What did you see at City Hall?
Well, they went to one of the entrances of City Hall. It's not the main one where you normally go through. I spoke to Rasheena Aldridge. She's on the Ferguson Commission. He's been protesting for a while now. He said they were trying to get inside City Hall to protest, but a security guard stopped them, tried to close the doors on them. They tried to keep the doors open. Police came, made them leave, said there's an unlawful assembly when I talked to Captain Dan Howard with St. Louis Metropolitan Police, he said that someone made contact with the security guard, and at that point it became an unlawful assembly.
So what's going on right now with these 150 or so protesters near Keener Plaza? Are police on the scene?
They are. They're kind of standing back. I see several police in the row, police cars, flashing lights. But they're staying back, just observing now that they're off the street.
Give us a contrast of how different or similar this is from what we've seen even yesterday during the day during protests.
Well, yesterday there was a little bigger crowd, at least 200, and the police stayed back until the protesters got on the highway. And today it sounds like in some ways it's similar because, again, the police moved forward when there was contact made or something that was more overt. But it's a little different. It's a little hard to tell for sure what is the deciding point when they come in.
Thanks so much, Camille Phillips, from our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom. Stay safe out there.
Thank you. I will.
We're now going to turn to the president of the NAACP, Cornell Brooks, about the organization's reaction to the grand jury decision. Mr. Brooks, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. It's good to be with you.
In a moment, I want to ask you about the NAACP's journey for justice. But first, I want to get your initial reaction to the grand jury's decision not to indict Officer Darren Wilson.
The decision was both distressing and disappointing for a couple of reasons. The first of which is that the grand jury process itself did not inspire confidence, to say the least. Where we have prosecutors around the country who conclude that this process has been unusual and uninspiring and deeply troubling, in that you have a county prosecutor who dumps mountains of evidence into the laps of grand jurors with very little direction for days on end, and essentially conducts a criminal trial in the context of a grand jury proceeding. Enough that it suggests that you have a legal absurdity wrapped in a moral outrage. This is not what the people were expecting. That's the first point. The second point here is where we have fundamentally an unarmed teenager who meets a police officer with a gun, badge, and training, where the teenager is initially suspected of jaywalking and the teenager ends up dead. This grand jury proceeding has not provided any light on that, and beyond that, we have a press conference following the grand jury proceeding where the county prosecutor manages to malign the witnesses, malign the victim, Michael Brown, where he can't defend himself, and makes a mockery of the process. This is not the kind of thing that inspires confidence and has, in fact, inspired outrage. And so the critical question for us is, what can we now do? How can we find justice in the midst of these very difficult circumstances?
Well, moving forward, you've said that the organization will work to address what you call over-aggressive policing culture. What do you mean by that, and how do you plan to do it?
Certainly. The challenge here is several fold. First of which is we have a real problem in this country with over-aggressive policing that also happens to be ineffective policing, and this is combined with racial profiling. So consider this: where you have a criminal justice system where one out of every three African American males can expect to spend some time in prison. One out of every four African-American males reports being treated unjustly or unfairly by the police within the last month, according to Gallup. Consider this. African American males are 21 more times likely to lose their lives at the hands of the police than white males. The point being here is that we have a real problem. This is not an imagined problem. This is not a fictitious problem. This is a real problem. And Michael Brown's tragic death represents not an individual instance of police misconduct, but it feels like, for many young people, a generational assault. They feel, based upon real experience, that they are in the midst of a pandemic of police misconduct. So then our challenge is, how do we address this problem at the state level, at the local level, and at the federal level? One of the ways that the NAACP is doing this is by engaging in peaceful, nonviolent protests where we're focused on real reform, justice for Michael Brown in the immediate instance, and an end to the kind of policing that led to Michael Brown's death in the longer term. And what that means for us is a march from the home and the hometown of Michael Brown, Ferguson, to the home of the governor in Jefferson City.
This is the Journey for Justice, correct?
That's exactly it. A Journey for Justice, over 100 miles, over the course of 7 days, where we will present to the country, to the nation, and make the case for a fundamental reform of the way in which police departments treat the communities in which they are policing. And that means at the national level, establishing a national standard for excessive use of force, passing the End to Racial Profiling Act. At the state level, vigorously enforcing Missouri's racial profiling law. With respect to the Department of Justice, having the Department of Justice and calling upon them to complete their investigation into the killing of Michael Brown, and also their investigation with respect to the Ferguson Police Department and any other police departments that fall within their jurisdiction in terms of their concerns about civil rights violations. A monitoring of the Ferguson Police Department, the implementation of civilian review panels, so that where you have instances of police brutality, something can be done. The point being here is we're going to march almost 50 years later from the Selma to Montgomery march, which began when a young man by the name of Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed at the hands of a police officer. So nearly a half century later, we're beginning a similar march that's twice as long from Ferguson to Jefferson City to lift up the challenge of unlawful, unethical, immoral policing in this country.
Cornell Brooks, president of the NAACP, thank you so much for your time. We'll see you in St. Louis this weekend on Saturday for the Journey for Justice. We're going to take a short break now and be back in just a moment with St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay and get more insight into the recently released grand jury documents. You're listening to St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. We're back with more of St. Louis on the Air. We move now from Ferguson to St. Louis, which saw some small protests last night in the Central West End, as well as on South Grant in the Shaw neighborhood. Earlier in the week, Shaw some 200 protesters, some of whom vandalized buildings. We're joined right now in studio by Mayor Francis Slay to give us an update on the state of the city. Mayor Slay, welcome to the show.
Happy to be with you, Stephanie.
I want to start by asking about what our reporter Camille Phillips told us is going on down near City Hall right now. What's going on there?
Well, a number of protesters, certainly over 100. They first gathered at Keener Plaza this morning, and they moved towards to the east of downtown to start with, and then started walking down to towards City Hall. They blocked the traffic at Tucker and Market for some time, not a lot of time, just a few minutes, and then went over to City Hall and tried to get into the building.
Would you classify that as a break-in into City Hall?
No, they didn't break into City Hall. None of the protesters actually entered the building.
What else do you see going on in your city right now as the population is processing the grand jury's decision in the Michael Brown case. We've obviously heard what's going on in Ferguson. What about in the city itself?
Well, in the city itself, I mean, what we do know is that, you know, what happened in Ferguson, the shooting of Michael Brown on August the 9th, is something that didn't just impact Ferguson, it just didn't impact St. Louis County. It's something that impacted the entire region and, as we're seeing, the entire country. And the reason for that is because what it did was bring to the surface and magnify issues and concerns that have been around for a long, long time that really revolve around race, economic disparities, racial inequities in economic opportunity, in terms of policing, policing tactics, governance, a lot of things that really were brought to the surface, and these are things that impact the city of St. Louis as well. And so, what's happening in the city now is there are a lot of people that are they want to make sure that their voices are heard. They want to make sure that government leaders are listening, that civic leaders and business leaders are listening, and that we just don't listen, that we actually take positive measures to address all these things. Now, the governor did appoint a Ferguson Commission. I mean, it's a diverse organization of individuals who have been charged to take a leadership role on a on a regional basis, and I think even statewide as well, to address a lot of these disparities and to work on dealing with them in very positive and meaningful ways. And in the meantime, we've been working on a lot of these issues for quite some time as well. But I think the incident in Ferguson really did, again, as I said, magnify the issues and raise a lot of eyebrows, get the attention of a lot of people who didn't really understand fully the magnitude of these issues, the importance of them, and the deep-seated feelings that have been expressed in some cases in violent ways in our community.
Well, it's those disruptive expressions that I want to ask you about. You were on South Grand yesterday, and you talked to business owners there who had their businesses damaged. What did you hear from them?
Well, first of all, resilience. These are business owners that care deeply about the city, care deeply about their businesses. They're invested there. They love South Grand. They love the neighborhood, the Shaw neighborhood in the South Grand area of the city of St. Louis. And they like their customers. But, of course, they were concerned about, what's going to happen the next night, what's going to happen next week. And we wanted to make sure we let them know that the city is doing everything we can from a law enforcement standpoint to protect their businesses, and we assured them of that, and we also wanted to make sure that we weren't going to tolerate violence. The other thing that I talked to them about was the city's we're putting together a program that is going to allow them to – we're going to reimburse them for some of the costs of, dealing with the damages and repairing their stores and those things. And I also wanted to reassure them that from a law enforcement standpoint, we were going to continue our efforts to protect them and to weed out the bad actors, the violent actors. And in my view, those aren't protesters. Those are criminals, people that are destroying property and causing damage in that regard. And also the fact that we are working very hard on addressing, as I said, those issues that have been really magnified with the shooting of Michael Brown, so that we can address the concerns of those who are protesting and make St. Louis a fairer and a more just place for everyone.
Have you or other city officials been communicating directly with protest groups? And if so, how is that communication taking place?
Yes, we have been for quite some time now, a couple of months, have been communicating with leadership within the protesting community. And I will say that to try to characterize the protesting community in any way would be wrong, because it's a very diverse group of people of different ethnicities, different education and economic backgrounds and all those things. And in many ways, there wasn't a whole lot of organization. There was a Hands Up and a Don't Shoot organization, and the Hands Up, Don't Shoot coalition was made up of over 50 different organizations with various levels of leadership. So we did have some, we had discussions. I personally met with some protesters. My staff and a lot of other people were meeting with leadership within the protesting community to establish a dialogue, to establish a level of communication, to try to help keep protesters safe, try to help keep our police officers safe, and also to try to help keep our citizens and the businesses safe as well. We made a lot of progress. There is a line of communication. We have individuals that we talk to that are have taken leadership roles, but they don't pretend, nor do we expect that they represent everybody, because anybody can come in and protest, and everyone has reasons why they're there, and not everybody is going to follow any individual. And we get that, and we understand it. But but that's something you have to understand as you go forward. But the communication was very good. The protesters became more organized as we went forward, which was a good thing, because the more organization there is, the better it is that we have a chance of you know, having a leadership that we're talking to have some involvement and some leadership in terms of how things go to, again, keep protesters safe, protect their constitutional rights, as well as keep other people safe as well in their businesses and their property.
Well, speaking of communication, are you satisfied with the information that you're getting and receiving from Unified Command and the ability to speak with the authorities there?
Yes.
Can you expand on that a little?
Well, we have a Unified Command, and it's important that it is unified and that we're talking and we're working together, because again, this is something that impacts the entire region, and have a lot of similar issues that we're dealing with. But in the city of St. Louis itself, the police chief, Sam Dotson, is in charge of our police force. He reports to Richard Gray, who is our director of public safety, both of whom report to me directly. So basically, I'm in charge in the city of St. Louis. So, but it is important that we coordinate and talk to the people in command in the other areas from the state, because we have the National Guard in town. We have the county police and other law enforcement out there that, you know, we talk about tactics. We talk about sharing experiences. We talk about, you know, on an ongoing basis how we address different situations. We can learn from each other as well. And we've learned. Everybody's learned a lot since August the 9th. And I think that's good for everybody, good for law enforcement. It's good for the community, good for the protesters as well. But this is not an exact science. There's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot of things that happen without necessarily anyone planning. And, of course, when you have large crowds, there's a lot of things can happen. And in some cases, the criminal element will use the crowds as cover to commit violence, which, you know, protesters understand and the police officers do as well. So the communication is always very good. So our police chief is always in communication with Captain Johnson, as well as Chief Belmar, and of course from the state as well.
You initially requested 400 National Guard troopers for the city of St. Louis. Was that actually granted, those 400?
We actually received more than 400, yes.
Were there any concerns that the city was diverting National Guard resources from the area where the biggest protests ended up happening?
Well, no. Well, and the reason we knew for sure that, first of all, you can't predict everything and where it's going to be and what the level of protests, how many people are going to show up. But we were asking for 400. I don't know what the county asked for, and I'm not sure how many they received, but as you know, it went from 700 and something to total to, I think for St. Louis County, up to 2,200. So there, and how that all went, I think our chief can talk more about that. But I can tell you that what I was concerned about was what was happening in the city of St. Louis as well. We were experiencing some protests there as well, and we wanted to make sure that the police officers that we have are supported. They're working 12-hour shifts. They've been doing this for quite some time. There's a level of fatigue and tiredness in the cops. We want to make sure they're on their best in terms of their energy level, and they have families they have to go home to as well. So having the backup from the National Guard really helped them do their jobs better. The National Guard played a very secondary role in the city. They were not on the front lines. They were not dealing directly with protesters unless, of course, protesters showed up someplace where the National Guard were. And we made sure it was our police officers that are dealing directly with the protesters. That way we can put the police officers where they needed to be, and the National Guard can be in, you know, protecting shopping centers, protecting police departments, protecting the fire departments, places that we think may be targeted of maybe random lootings away from our damage or property damage, away from where the protesters are. So we wanted to make sure we had the resources necessary to just support our cops so they can do their jobs well, and they can protect the protesters' constitutional rights as well as, you know, the constitutional rights of people that are not involved in the protesting.
So the National Guard wasn't necessarily called in to protect those businesses right where those protests were happening, those businesses that ended up getting damaged.
That is not – that's correct, not necessarily.
Well, Mayor, what is your message to the city right now?
The city of St. Louis, we have to – what we need to do is, first of all, my message is this, is nonviolence is the most productive approach to addressing these issues. That if we want change, violence isn't going to accomplish change. All it will do is divide people. We need people coming together, working together to address all these issues that I'm talking about. You know, policing, the governance, you know, all these municipalities we have and all these police departments that are out in St. Louis County and all those things need to be addressed and some other things as well. And I think as important as anything is that we come together in more unified and a more determined way to address the racial disparities that we not only are experiencing here in St. Louis but all over the country. So I'm going to be helping lead the effort, continuing to lead the effort to address all these different issues so that St. Louis can be a more just and a more fair community for everyone.
Mayor Francis Slay, thanks so much for coming on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take one last break here, and when we come back, we'll learn more about the grand jury documents that have been released and learn about how we can talk to our children about the events we're seeing in Ferguson. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. You're listening to St. Louis on the Air. As promised, St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCullough has released thousands of pages of evidence presented to the grand jury, including witness testimony, lab reports, and other investigative documents. We're joined now in studio by St. Louis Public Radio reporters Chris McDaniel and Rachel Lippman. Thanks so much for coming in and giving us an update.
It's such a far trip for us to be in here.
Well, first, Rachel, Chris, let me ask you, what is new that you're finding in the documents?
Well, yesterday we talked a lot about Officer Darren Wilson's testimony, and that was definitely the first time that we've seen that. Since then, I've spent a considerable amount of time going through Dorian Johnson's sworn testimony. And while he's spoken to the media a lot, you know, this was the first time he was under oath. So getting into it a little bit, there were some serious differences, perhaps unsurprisingly, between his testimony and Darren Wilson's. It started from the first confrontation, which was Darren Wilson saying, you know, why don't you guys walk on the sidewalk? According to Dorian Johnson, it was get the F on the sidewalk.
And just as a reminder, Dorian Johnson was Michael Brown's friend who was with him during this confrontation.
Yes, and earlier in the day during the robbery.
For me, I don't know that there's been anything necessarily new in terms of information about this case, other than there's sort of broad outlines of what has happened and that have sort of been known from the beginning. The details are what's different. What struck me in the day of testimony that I managed to get through was how much and how deep the mistrust of law enforcement is in this area. Every single witness on that day, there were four of them, mentioned either that the Ferguson Police Department specifically, or one even said she had just a gut feeling where she needed to record the interaction between Michael Brown, Darren Wilson, and Dorian Johnson. And I've actually started going through Wilson's initial report to St. Louis County. It would have been the first statement that he made to police. He was taken back apparently to the Ferguson Police Department headquarters from the scene simply because they were afraid of for his safety. So we're getting through that. He first apparently spoke to detectives around 2:30 p.m. on August 9th.
Now, a lot of criticism has been leveled at St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCullough for his presentation of conflicting witness testimony when he announced the grand jury's decision. But are you seeing that supported in the documents that you're going through?
I mean, the testimony is incredibly conflicting. And all of these people are sworn under oath when they're giving it. And that's, I think that might be surprising for a lot of people. But it goes from, you know, differences in opinion or of what they saw for the big things down to small things too. I mean, whether or not the lights were on Officer Wilson's SUV. One construction worker we found said that there were three officers, which out of all of the other witnesses, no one else said that. And it's I don't know. It's quite bizarre how drastically different these all are.
I read one witness who said she did see two officers in the car. So it would have been Wilson and a partner riding with him. Of course, we know that wasn't the case. I think, though, and this is something that Prosecutor McCullough said the first night, people believed what they were saying. He didn't think that most of the witnesses were just kind of making this up, that they actually believed what they were seeing. And it's not necessarily news or new to anyone that eyewitness testimony can be incredibly conflicting. Your brain has to fill in gaps as to what you saw and didn't see. And a lot of them say, I didn't see the whole thing. I didn't see the first start of the confrontation. I only heard the gunshot. So,
yeah, we've heard on the program on St. Louis on the Air before about how witness testimony can often be conflicting because it's so difficult for people to process in these kinds of traumatic incidents what they're seeing. One of the things, though, that we haven't heard about before is the role of the assistant prosecutors during this grand jury presentation. Chris, can you tell us a little more about that?
So I think there is this line of thinking that these grand jurors, they have all of the power. They're the ones who make the decision about whether or not to indict. It's all out of the county prosecutor's hands. I'm about 800 pages in, and I have to say that a lot of the lines of questioning, a lot of how this is moving forward, a lot of the questioning is coming from these two assistant county prosecutors that are in the room. So they do have a lot of say in it.
And I had one legal expert tell me yesterday that they can go in with this idea of whether or not they want an indictment. And lines of questioning can either lead to or away from a post – or not a post, a position, excuse me, if they want it to. And he said that he thought deference had been given to Darren Wilson's story and therefore Darren Wilson from the very beginning, which implied to him and someone else I talked to that they weren't necessarily seeking an indictment in this case, that they maybe subconsciously, unconsciously thought, we don't want to get an indictment in this case.
Well, I'm pretty sure you both have about a few thousand more pages to go through, so we're going to let you go. Rachel Lippman and Chris McDaniel, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
We're going to switch up the conversation a little bit now and look at how we can talk about these events in Ferguson and around St. Louis with our children. We're joined now by Dr. Ken Haller. He's an associate professor of pediatrics at St. Louis University and a pediatrician at SSM Cardinal Glennon Children's Medical Center. He joins us by phone now from my old stomping grounds on Long Island, New York. Dr. Haller, welcome.
Stephanie, great to talk to you. I'm from Hicksville. Where are you from?
Oyster Bay. So close.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Dr. Haller, what is your primary concern for children who are witnessing these events, either in person, in the media, or through even hearing adults talk?
Well, there's so much we could talk about, but it basically breaks down to a few things. One is we have to appreciate where children are developmentally. The younger kids are, the harder it is for them to process stuff and the more they live in the moment. So if kids are seeing these images, if they're experiencing these things, if they're seeing things like this on TV or on video and seeing it over and over and over again, they think it keeps on happening, and that can be very, very frightening to them. So it really is important for parents to take the responsibility of editing this and turning off some of this stuff so the kids don't have to see it over and over and over again. As kids get older, they're going to have questions about what's going on. They're going to wonder, you know, why is this happening? And you know, where is this going? At that point, when kids are starting to ask these questions, the most important thing that parents can do is to say to kids, what do you think about this? What do you feel about this? Because while parents may think they know what's going on with their kids, oftentimes they don't. Kids may be feeling a lot of fear about this. They may be feeling fear for their own safety, for their parents' safety, or for the safety of people they're seeing on TV. And so it's really important to understand where the fear is coming from. It's also really important to understand there may be other things going on. Kids may be feeling a lot of compassion for the people who are going through this, whose shops have been burned down, things like that. And so really talking to kids, finding out what their concerns are, where they're coming from, is just really, really paramount at this time. In terms of kids directly involved, I wrote about this last week. It's really important, especially as we've seen things play out the past couple of days. Parents really need to be very, very thoughtful about taking kids to these demonstrations because, unfortunately, we've seen that sometimes they can get out of control. And as much as people may want their kids to be witnesses to this historic event that's going on right in our community, it's really important to understand that they may be able not to process it. And as kids get a little older, as they get to be school age, they may run off and get into trouble. It's an uncontrolled situation, and we really need to make sure our kids are safe through all of this.
Kids aren't always the best communicators of how they're feeling.
Right.
So what are some of the things that parents should be looking for, behaviors, actions that kids are taking that shows they might be suffering from a lot of anxiety at this moment?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, kids sometimes don't really say directly what's going on. So if kids' routines are getting out of whack, if it's, whether it's because of outside forces or if it seems like they're not eating as much, they're not sleeping very well, they're acting in ways they're very nervous, parents, it's really important for them to say, hey, I noticed that you're seeming a little anxious. Tell me about that. And what parents can do at this point, if the kids are not forthcoming, even though they think something's going on, is that parents really can have a conversation with kids and say, something, I've been seeing these things on TV. This is how I feel about it. But I really want you to know that I am going to do everything I can to keep you safe. You're the most important person in the world to me. And I just really want to make sure that you know that I am always here to take care of you. So sometimes giving that reassurance can be enough to make a kid relax enough so that they can express what's going on and they can, they can be fully present to the whole situation.
I imagine the challenge with that, though, is that plenty of adults right now are experiencing a lot of stress. So
exactly.
How do we keep our stress and our emotions about this from impacting our children?
That's a great question. And especially with Thanksgiving coming up and people, and being around other people in our families, which, is often very complex. This can be a time where we have to be very, very mindful of what's going on. Certainly anyone who's spent any time on social media knows that right now there's a lot of stuff going out there that's been unfiltered, that's very raw. And I think if there's one thing that we all need to do whenever we look at our kids is it should be natural for us when we look at our kids to say, when I'm in the presence of my child, I need to be the best version of myself I can be, because who do I want this child to be growing up? Who do I want them to be? Do I want them to be a person filled with anger? Do I want them to be a person filled with fear? Do I want them to be a person filled with compassion and love? And so, one of the things I think parents find out very, very quickly is that you have to be a grown-up and that sometimes you don't have time to process this stuff, but you have to move to a place of compassion, to a place of having this other person in your life, seeing the world through their eyes, and just letting them know that you are there for them. And especially as we're heading into the holidays and looking at what we're thankful for, having conversations with the other adults that we may be with over the next few days and say, what are we going to say to each other about the situation in Ferguson when our kids are present? What do we want them thinking, not just tomorrow, but in 5 years or 10 years when they think back on Thanksgiving 2014? It's really important that people go through this process right now if there are children in their lives so that they can be fully present to their children and help them to be the people that we all hope that they'll be.
Well, Dr. Ken Haller, thank you so much Dr. Ken Haller, thank you so much for joining us again. And if you drive by Oyster Bay, give it a hello for me.
I will. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Thank you. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll have a holiday encore presentation of Don's discussion with historian Fred Foss about his new book documenting 250 years of St. Louis history. And Friday, join Steve Potter for Cityscape, when he'll talk about New Jewish Theater's production of Becoming Dr. Ruth, the State of Blues Music in St. Louis, and the Rock and Roll Craft Show. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. From myself, the missing Don Marsh, and the rest of the staff here at St. Louis on the Air, we are wishing you a very happy Thanksgiving. I'm Stephanie Lecce. You're listening to St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU.